Hi, everybody. Welcome to our Krauss Financial CLE for June 11th. We are doing retirement assets and Medicaid crisis planning part two. My name is Jim Wolverton, and I'm the director of legal education here at Krauss Financial. And I'm joined today by my good friend, Mark Munson. For those of you that don't know about Krauss Financial, I'll go through this real quickly. Is we are an attorney-led firm that provide asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. Using our specialized insurance products, resources, and support, we help attorneys streamline the process of advising clients planning for long-term care. You can see, once I can see it, we have 30-plus years of experience in this field. The founder, Dale Krauss, was one of the first to use Medicaid-compliant annuities to help clients get qualified for Medicaid benefits, and it has had a growth in the last 30 years, up to 40 professionals on staff, me being one of those. And then we handle about 400 Medicaid compliant annuity cases monthly. So our planners have seen what there is to see and can help you and your clients work through any sort of complicated issues that you're working with as you're preparing your clients to qualify for Medicaid benefits. So that's about Krauss and a little bit about Mark. Mark is an attorney at Ruder Ware, which is in, how do you say this, Mark?
Wausau.
Okay. There's a lot of U's in there. I wasn't sure if I should pronounce or not. Mark Cecila, he has always been very open and active in the elder law community, talking about new strategies, complicated strategies, and how to help other attorneys. Always very open to conversation. Mark and I like to try to come up with the most complicated strategies and try to figure our way out of them. Mark has been an engaged member of NALA for many years, both locally in Wisconsin and also on the national board from 2016 to 2020. So Mark is an excellent resource, and thank you so much for being here, Mark. I really appreciate it.
For having me.
So what we'll do for those of you that are on the webinar that weren't able to join us for part one a couple months ago is I will run through a fairly quick recap of part one. And what I really wanted to do was pull out the foundational concepts that we need to run through part two, which primarily, once we get into the meat of it, is going to be case studies. So we're going to take the concepts that we introduced in part one and then really apply them with the case studies, which will be the meat of the presentation here today, to kind of see how these cases come through. And Mark will give his analysis of if he had one of these cases come into his office, what he would do. And so we'll go through that. If you do have questions, please feel free to use the question box. I have that up, and I will be monitoring that. The PowerPoint, if you want to print that out, is in the materials section in GoToWebinar. And then for the CLE section, for the CLE credit, fill out the survey at the end of this presentation. That'll let us know that you attended all the way through the end, and then we have that interaction with you to prove that you didn't fall asleep. So we can get you that CLE credit, and we'll send over that certificate of attendance once we get that survey back. So now that the housekeeping's out of the way, I'll breeze through a recap of part one, and Mark, please feel free to interject if I go too quickly through anything that needs to have a little bit more context placed on it to be able to understand the case studies. So what we talked about in part one was really laying out the different types of retirement accounts. And most of you on this call probably already know these, but we did want to give you just a nice overview of the different types that we discussed and that we'll be using in our case studies. So we have the traditional IRA. The key components of this is the contributions to the account are deductible fully or partially, and generally those amounts are not taxed until you take a distribution. So those are sitting there pre-taxed. Once they come out, that's when you'd be paying taxes, and that's income tax, correct, Mark?
Right.
And so with a Roth IRA, it is different because you cannot deduct the contributions to a Roth IRA. And the qualified distributions are tax-free, and that's because the Roth is funded with money that has already been taxed. So those are those don't require any minimum distributions and have less restrictions on them because, in the way I like to think about them, is the taxes have already been paid. IRS doesn't, they're not waiting to get their hands on those taxes on those Roth IRAs because they've already been paid. Then we have the 401k. So the 401k allows employees to contribute a portion of their wages to an individual retirement account, and this is done through salary deferrals that are excluded from the employee's taxable income. And what's nice about these is the employers, as a retaining tool, as a way to get employees to stick around, can contribute to those employee accounts. So that's when you have an employee puts money into this account pre-tax, and then the employer can match it, and usually it's to a certain percentage based on what their HR policies are. And then there's the 403B plan, and these are very similar to the 401k plans, but they're offered to public schools and certain nonprofits, so kind of the more public sector side of the 401k plans, where you can, as an employee, defer those salaries into the account. They can grow, and then employers can also match what type of contribution the employee has made. So those are the different types of accounts that we covered in part one. And then when we bring it into Medicaid planning, the way that I like to teach how retirement accounts are treated as countable resources is kind of the baseline concept is assume that they are unless the state specifically excludes them. So those retirement accounts would go towards the individual resource amount or the community spouse resource amount unless they're specifically excluded by the state. And states can exclude accounts, retirement accounts of both spouses or just the community spouse. And you can see here on this chart how the states kind of fall out. Most states have those retirement accounts as countable, and then community spouse, there's a few states there that have that exempt, and then those states that are shaded in black, both the accounts are exempt. So not as big as a concern when you're dealing with countable resources and getting your clients qualified with those retirement accounts. But again, generally, when you look into your Medicaid manual, even on those states where they are excluded, they do have to be being paid out in some sort of periodic payment with, obviously, those accounts that do require required minimum distributions on them. So then we turned and we looked at annuities. So there are different types of annuities as well. And the most complex, and I know Mark and I could go back and forth on these for the rest of the time if we wanted to, but we're going to try to zoom through this, are those deferred annuities. These are those accounts that your clients are probably going to bring to you where they talk to a financial advisor. The financial advisor advised that they get a deferred annuity, so they have a set amount of income coming in each month where the principal is invested in and then is annuitized at a later date. So that's where the deferral comes in. They're not automatically paying, they're growing, and then at some point they'll start paying out a source of income. Generally, when you look at Medicaid manuals, these will qualify as countable resources. And the reason for that is, and if you look at this definition that I pulled from the CFRs, it says cash or other liquid assets that an individual owns and can convert to cash to be used for his or her support and maintenance are going to be considered a countable resource. So that convert to cash, the ability to go get those funds, turn them off, and get money out of them is what makes that a countable resource. And those deferred annuities, it might not be advantageous from a tax perspective or a penalties and fees perspective, but you can get money out of those. And so Medicaid is generally going to say those are countable resources. And I pulled an example from the Wisconsin Medicaid manual that states that annuities are considered available. Countable assets include annuities that can be surrendered. That would be one of these deferred type of annuities, would be a countable resource. Now there's also immediate annuities. So these are annuitized accounts that pay out within the year of purchase, and it pays out principal and income over a certain period of time. And this is where the Medicaid compliant annuity is going to come in, because once you make the election to annuitize this annuity, it's irrevocable and it cannot be undone. So now it's immediately paying, it's not deferred. We've taken that ability to liquidate this into cash off the table. Therefore, the Medicaid manuals treat this a little bit differently. Again, going back to the Wisconsin Medicaid manual for an example, you can see that it states that an irrevocable annuity may or may not be considered an available countable asset depending on when it was purchased and whether it can be sold on the secondary market. So that brings us into this availability to be able to create, to convert to cash, to make those accounts convertible, and they usually have a carve out for irrevocable immediate annuities are not countable resources. So they're non-countable resources. And that's really the difference between these deferred annuities and immediate annuities. And here, Mark, I'll take a moment because I'm sure you have lots of thoughts on these different annuities and how they kind of function. But is there anything you want to add here that we covered in part one that would be relevant to our case studies as we get into those?
Sure. So, you know, the important thing to note with regard to immediate annuities, I mean, deferred annuities are always just going to be available assets or, you know, counted assets. So it's going to go towards the $2,000 asset limit or whatever your state assets limit is for a single individual. It's going to go towards the community spouse resource allowance, plus the individual allowance for a married couple. So deferred annuities are really somewhat simple because they're available assets. Immediate annuities are, as Jim mentioned, are tricky. They can be, immediate annuities are very, 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 very tricky because it is possible under relevant Medicaid law, and you have to look at your state to see how they treat it. But in an immediate annuity can be, well, it's always going to be income. It's always, always going to be monthly income. So, you know, when you're looking at, you know, getting someone qualified and eligible for Medicaid, you know, on the financial side, you have to look at assets and income. Well, if there's an immediate annuity, that payment, presumably it's a monthly payment, that's going to be income for purposes of the Medicaid application, for purposes of Medicaid eligibility. But it is also possible for that immediate annuity to be considered to be an available asset. And, you know, what I mean by that is this. Let's say that I have an immediate annuity and it's paying me $100 a month for 50 months. Now, if I don't know any better and I'm really, really hurting for money, could I sell my right to receive $100 a month for the next 50 months, could I sell that to Jim for $10? I mean, the answer is yes, and Jim would clearly say, hey, I'm a buyer.
I'll take that deal.
I will buy that from you, Mark, so that I'm now the recipient of that $100 for the next 50 months, and you only had to pay $10 to get it. And that's unfortunately where this concept of if you have an immediate annuity, that's where it can be an available asset because you might be able to sell your account receivable. That's kind of an right. accounting term and an accounting concept, but you might be able to sell that. And, you know, the whole mortgage-backed security crisis was based on the selling of an account receivable. And so you have to be able to demonstrate that you can't sell it. And no one, you know, either because of the terms, and we'll get there, or because nobody in the secondary market wants it. And so that's, you know, so I kind of go into immediate annuities. Okay, these things are income. they are also potentially available assets, because can you sell it? And if so, for how much? And then on top of that, it could also be a gift or a transfer for less than fair market value if the terms of this immediate annuity are not Medicaid compliant as required by federal law. So you really have, these things can be incredibly problematic from an eligibility standpoint and doing that application, because you have one financial product in an immediate annuity that is income, that could be also be an asset, and that could also be a transfer for less than fair market value. And none of that, you'd say, how could one thing be all three things at the same time? And Congress said, we don't care. This is the way it's going to be. This is the law. And so these immediate annuities can be incredibly problematic.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. And it's a natural transition into what is a Medicaid compliant annuity and how does it not have all those features, is kind of a negative way to say what are the features of a Medicaid compliant annuity that's excluded for Medicaid purposes. The first is it's irrevocable, so it cannot be revoked or altered. So it's immediate. You can't change that. It's non-assignable. Now we've taken away the cash value because you can't sell it, so it can't be transferred to another party or sold on the secondary market. It also has to be actuarially sound so that the term of the annuity is equal to or less than the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. So it can't be greater, it can't go longer than the owner's life expectancy. This was a concept that for some reason I had a tough time. I was always like, it can't be shorter or longer. So it can't be longer. It must be shorter in term than the person's life expectancy. It has to have equal payments, can't have a deferral or a balloon payment. So it's immediate, paying out equal payments. You can't play games with it with a deferral at the end of it. And then the kicker is it has to have the state named as the beneficiary in the proper position. So because of the federal guidelines around these particular requirements, that's what we'll get into in the case studies, how you can use these to transition a problematic account for Medicaid compliant or Medicaid qualification purposes into one that helps you create a stream of income, to Mark's point, but the balance does not count as an asset. And that's where the Medicaid compliant annuity can come into play as you're strategically thinking of what to do with assets over the individual resource amounts.
I'll just add that if you have an annuity that follows all of these things that Jim just mentioned, that the purchase of that type of immediate annuity, the purchase of a Medicaid compliant immediate annuity, is not a gift. It can't be construed as a gift, and it's not a transfer for less than fair market value and can't be construed that way. So If you're following the rules and doing a Medicaid compliant immediate annuity, all you're getting is income and you're avoiding the other two. It's not an asset. It cannot be a counted asset, and it cannot be considered to be a gift or a transfer for less than fair market value.
Excellent. So kind of from a really high level, and this is where we're going to hop into the case studies and kind of put some meat on these, the bare bones of this, is conceptually when you're using an MCA, a Medicaid compliant annuity, in crisis planning with non-qualified funds, basically what we're doing is the client has available assets above the individual or community spouse resource alliance allowances. Just like Mark mentioned, they take those liquid funds over the resource allowances. They purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity that creates a stream of income and removes those assets as countable. And because this specific type of annuity is written to comply with those rules that we just talked about, just like Mark said, it's not considered a transfer for less than fair market value and it can't be sold on the secondary market, so it has no value. With a single person, what you'll do there is generally gift away about half of the amount over the countable resource limits. which is going to create a penalty. So you made a gift, you're intentionally creating a penalty, and then you take whatever is left after the gift to use the Medicaid compliant annuity, which is structured the exact same period of time over the penalty period you created. That's going to increase the amount of income, the applicant's original income plus the income from the Medicaid compliant annuity will give that person enough money to privately pay for their nursing home stay during the penalty period. Once the penalty period has passed, the MCA has exhausted itself. There's no longer any money in that. The client then becomes eligible for Medicaid benefits. And we're going to run through a case study about that. With a married couple, it's a little bit simpler because the community spouse can purchase an annuity in their own name to remove the excess above the CSRA, and then that accelerates the institutionalized spouse's Medicaid individual or eligibility. And so long as that annuity is less than the community spouse's life expectancy, they are the owner and they are receiving the payment from that. So long as the term is less, you're okay. But you need to talk to your clients and figure out what they need as far as income goes and how long they expect what their longevity is, their health. Obviously, we don't know that for sure, but we'd want to try to make sure that they don't pass away before the term of that annuity has run its course, because the state's going to be named as primary beneficiary on that annuity up to the extent of payments made on behalf of the institutionalized individual. So if the community spouse predeceases the term of that annuity, the state could then come in and collect on that annuity. Therefore, generally, attorneys in talking to our planners, kind of the average term of those is going to be 24 to 36 months to get those community spouse resources paid back as income to the community spouse. With the qualified or retirement funds, and this is what we're going to jump into with the case studies, you can use a Medicaid compliant annuity for those funds if they are countable to avoid that immediate income tax consequences that would come from immediate liquidation. So the other option, if you're not using an MCA, would be to cash out those retirement funds, pay all those taxes all at once, and then convert that into a Medicaid compliant annuity. But you can do that before, so you don't have to liquidate those accounts. So those funds are taxed as the income comes out, but you've taken a countable asset and turned it into a stream of income using the MCA, using those retirement funds. And because it has all those elements that we looked at, you avoid a gifting penalty, and those retirement accounts are no longer considered a resource or asset. So with that foundation, Mark, I'll hand it off to you to run through these case studies. Oh no, we don't have our pictures. I uploaded the wrong one. So we had some pictures on the other one that's uploaded, so I apologize that this isn't visually pleasing, and I'm terrified to pull it down and bring up the one with the cute pictures. So I apologize, folks, for the aesthetics. Oops, I went the wrong way. All right, Mark, you want to take it away?
So what we have is, you know, you're probably working with children on this one. Hopefully there's a good power of attorney in place so that the children can help their mother, Jane Doe, do some planning. Or maybe Jane is just fine and has a physical impairment rather than a cognitive one. But in any case, she's 86 years old. She's now in a nursing home, has an $8,000 per month cost of care. And Jane's assets are currently $102,000 in a savings account and $200,000 in a traditional IRA. So anything that we take out of that traditional IRA is going to be income for income tax purposes. And then Jane's monthly income, presumably Social Security, and then looks like also a pension in this case, totals $2,000. So those are kind of the baseline facts that we all, like to get. You know, if it's a single person crisis case, you know, the crisis being, you know, Jane's care is $8,000 a month. For most families, that presents a financial crisis. And so, so that's where, you know, those are the facts you're going to want. You're going to want the cost of care. You're going to want the monthly income. You're going to want the whatever the remaining assets are. So what do we do with all of this? Well, you're also going to want to know what your state has in place for a penalty divisor. You know, so if you gift assets and we have to calculate a penalty period, every state has its own penalty divisor, which is just the private pay, the average private pay nursing home rate in your state. Every state is required to determine that by federal law. So in our example, we've got a penalty divisor of $10,000. So, you know, what we're looking at here is, you know, Jane's has this savings account, checking account, and what we, and that has $102,000 in it, right? Right, Jim?
Yeah, let me, yep, 102. Yep,
102. So what we're advising there is that Jane gift $101,000 of that. And then if you do the math, $101,000 divided by $10,000, we're going to get 10.1 months of a penalty period. So pretty much 10 months. So Jane is going to need to privately pay for her care for the next 10 months. Why? Because she gifted $101,000, and that's going to result in a penalty period. So we know that. So how is it that we're going to help Jane make sure that she can pay through that 10-month penalty period? So as we've got noted here, Jane is going to use the assets, the money, whatever it is in her IRA, and she's going to purchase within her IRA an IRA Medicaid-compliant annuity, and that Medicaid-compliant annuity is going to pay her $5,800 a month for 10 months. And so her monthly income for the next 10 months will be her regular $2,000 that she'll get from Social Security and pension, but also she will get $5,800 a month from this Medicaid compliant annuity that is inside of Jane's IRA. Now, if you go back to the slide that Jim and I showed you about the requirements under federal law for a Medicaid compliant immediate annuity, right away you should see a problem with this Medicaid compliant annuity, because we've got $200,000 in it, but we're only going to be paying out $5,800 a month for 10 months. And that's $58,000. So at the end of 10 months, this annuity is over, which must mean that there's going to be a balloon payment with this particular annuity. But you would recall from the slide from earlier today that, hey, Jim said balloon payments are problematic. So what are you guys doing? Well, balloon payments are problematic with non-IRA money. Balloon payments are not problematic with IRA money. So all of those rules, irrevocable, non-assignable, even payments, actuarially sound, all of those requirements, all of them, all four of those requirements are for non-IRA Medicaid compliant annuities. all four of those rules do not apply to IRA Medicaid compliant annuities. But being a conservative practitioner, not wanting to get in trouble, you probably do want to make sure it's irrevocable, can't be undone, and number two, that it's non-assignable, not transferable, not saleable, not negotiable, all the whatever terms you want to use, so that you don't run into or can't get hit with available asset arguments. But the balloon payment and the the even payment requirement, no balloons, you can do that with a retirement account, an IRA, Medicaid compliant annuity. Life expectancy, you that's not a requirement with respect to a Medicaid compliant annuity that's inside of a retirement account, like an IRA. So if you look at this example and what Jim has kind of put together here, there's going to be a balloon payment with this IRA for Jane. And that's kind of nice to the practitioner, because if, this is where elder law gets a little bit morbid. None of us should like that, but it is the nature of our profession, is that, okay, if we get through this penalty period, the 10-month penalty period, and Jane is still doing really, 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 really well, okay, well, she's now got a decent chunk of money in her IRA. What the heck are we going to do with that? So what we've put forth here is, okay, we're going to have to probably take some money out to pay some tax, because this is income for income tax purposes. And then we're also going to take out some money to make another gift. And in this example, it's $71,000. So if we take out $71,000, that's income for income tax purposes. And that's why Jim has also got it on here that, we're going to do $29,000 of tax. So in effect, we're kind of taking out nearly $100,000, and we're earmarking $30,000 for tax, and we're paying that in. It's either going to be withholding, or it's going to be an estimated payment that we make. That's a spend down, so that's not a gift. Paying your taxes is not a gift. So then, so if we got, let's just say we got a $100,000 check from the IRA company. Well, we're going to pay $29,820 in tax. That's a spend down. And then we're going to gift $71,000, and that's going to create a penalty period. $71,000 divided by $10,000 is 7.1. And so we have a 7-month penalty, and now we got to use that remaining money within the IRA to purchase yet another Medicaid compliant annuity inside of the IRA, so that we've got money to pay through the penalty period. So what's happened here is, Jane, we started with $302,000. So we had $102,000 in checking and savings, and we had $200,000 in an IRA. We've got out $171,000 in gifted assets. The family gets that. Jane has used $99,000 of her money, IRA money, to pay for her care. Chances are her care is going to be at least part of it will probably be a qualified health care expense. So that income that's coming off of from the IRA can be offset a little bit by Jane's long-term care expenses. I mean, she's not paying $8,000 a month because this place is the greatest apartment in the whole wide world. It's $8,000 a month because there's a medically necessary care component attached to it. And that qualifies as an eligible or qualified healthcare or medical expense. And then there's going to be tax. You can't get around the income taxes. But you have helped, you know, Jane and her family preserve a, more than half of her assets in this example. So $171,000 net of taxes, net of income taxes, went to the family.
That's a great result. Okay. That is our case study number one. So that is our single person gift and annuity. The names on these were written when I was in the throes of the Denver Nuggets playoff run, which ended short this year. So you'll see our second case study is our friend Nikola Jokic, and she's going to use a standalone annuity strategy. Mark, do you want to work through that and kind of talk about when you'd look to use this strategy rather than a gift and annuity strategy?
Sure. So 86 years old, but, and you know, again, you're probably working with a widow, but the widow's daughter has told you that, you know, Nicola's life expectancy is not all that long, and you know they're probably getting that from the medical team and the doctors. So again, kind of similar fact pattern. She's at a nursing home, $8,000 a month. All that's left is, you know, okay, there's probably a checking account that doesn't have much to anything in it. And all that's left is mom's IRA because they're trying to hold off and save on the taxes. So mom is her income is $2,000 a month. So once again, you know, one of the first things I do in every case that involves a single person is I like to know what the monthly shortfall is or what the monthly deficit is. And so in this case, it's $6,000. So, you know, every month, Nicola needs to pay $8,000, but only has $2,000 coming in for income. So there's going to be a $6,000 monthly deficit every single month. So that's our shortfall. And the only way to deal with that shortfall is you have assets to pay through it, long-term care insurance if you have it. Now, Nicola doesn't. Veterans benefits is a way to bump up your income so that the monthly shortfall isn't so much, or else Medicaid. Those are really the, you know, options available. So, you know, we'll say Nicola has no veterans ability to get on any added veterans benefits and doesn't have any long-term care insurance. So in this case, you know, again, we noted that there's a $6,000 monthly deficit. And what you can do is, in this case, the plan is really to get Nicola on Medicaid right away. So if Nicola's got a, you know, a life expectancy based on a table, not based on what the doctors are saying, but based on a table, has a 6.26 year life expectancy, you could do a, you know, again, one of the requirements is it has to be actuarially sound, which means life expectancy or shorter. And so here we're just using the life expectancy, using her, if we purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity, using the whole amount, that's going to produce $2,667 a month for the next 75 months. Well, that's not enough. That is not enough to get Nicola paid in full. So this strategy is going to involve her monthly income being her pension and her pension and Social Security of $2,000, her Medicaid compliant annuity coming from an IRA being $2,667. So now she's up to $4,667. And then that deficit will be covered by Medicaid because the Medicaid compliant annuity within the IRA, it's not transfer, it's irrevocable and not transferable. She can't sell it. So it's not an asset anymore. So we've taken a $200,000 asset and made it only a stream of income. And so it's not an asset and it's not a gift if we do this. So her income is still not enough to meet the cost of care. So Medicaid needs to step in so that the care home, the nursing home, can get paid in full for taking care of Nicola.
And one thing that I added to this, that I don't think that it's the same number as the deficit, so it got a little confusing, but Medicaid doesn't pay the same rate that a private pay person pays. So in our situation here with Nicola, that first bullet point states that the Medicaid pay rate for the nursing home is $6,000 rather than the $8,000 she would be paying. So that's just another component to know when you're doing the standalone plan is, and you might not always know. Mark, do you always know what the Medicaid pay rate is at the facilities where your clients are?
You know, I know. I usually don't know, but okay. But I primarily am in Wisconsin, and there's an attorney who's kind of figured out where to look, and you know. So if that ever enters into the equation, I'm able to find that out. So you know, and these cases are really, you know, these are difficult, very, 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 very difficult conversations to have with families because they really depend on life expectancy.
Right.
And you know, if a family is very, 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 very positive, if you will, that you know, a life expectancy is shorter, then this is probably a pretty good strategy because of the difference of the private pay retail rate, if you will, compared to the Medicaid negotiated wholesale rate, if you will. And so, you know, if someone's going to live for 10 months, and yes, that's morbid and the worst part about our jobs, but if somebody's going to live 10 months and the difference between the retail rate and the wholesale rate or the private pay rate and the Medicaid rate is $3,000, well, 3 times 10 is $30,000. And it would be better to get them on Medicaid sooner and capture that difference. Now, when the person passes away, this is a single person case, who's the remainder beneficiary? Well, the remainder beneficiary is going to be your state, and we're going to have to pay for whatever Medicaid paid. But if you think about it, there's also an element of tax savings here because that payment is going to go from an IRA to a state. And I can't tell you if a state has to recognize a payment from an IRA as income for income tax purposes for the federal government. I'm guessing not, but I really don't. I don't know, and I don't care because neither one, the federal government or the state government's not my client. My clients, the individual and you know, kind of sometimes by indirectly, not directly, but the family. And so, you know, if you're going to, if this money has to come out, who wants to have to recognize it as income for income tax purposes? Would you rather have it be your client's children or the state? I'd much rather have it be the state. And plus it's lower. So, because you're only paying the you're only paying back the Medicaid rate. So, because what doesn't happen is it doesn't go from at death, it doesn't go from the IRA to your client, and then that's income for income, and then the client pays the state. It has to go directly from the IRA annuity to the state. And whether the state pays has to recognize that receipt as income for income tax purposes, I don't know, but I don't care either. All I know is that it's not going to my client or my client's children, and the rate, the total amount is less. You know, if it's, you know, $9,000 a month to be in the nursing home or 8,000, but the Medicaid rate is six, so that's $2,000 difference. If you lived for 10 months, okay, that's a $20,000 payback to the state, to your state, but that's less money than what you would have spent if you had to pull it out every month to privately pay. So it's much better to do that if there's a shorter life expectancy. If the life expectancy is longer, then you may want to look at the game of pulling it out. You know, that's income for income tax purposes, paying in some income tax and then gifting it and then using the remainder to do a Medicaid qualified or Medicaid compliant annuity within the IRA to help get you through that penalty period.
Yeah, so it's a weird, I was talking to an attorney about the strategy, and he goes, it's kind of a weird disincentive that the shorter the person's life expectancy in the standalone case, the more the family saves. And that could be a really weird conversation to have, like you said, with the family, where it comes to a better financial result, the worse their health is. So just be aware that that's not going to be a fun conversation to have with your clients. As you're thinking through this. But we have one more case study, and it's the spousal annuity. Here we have John and Molly Murray. Those of you that are basketball fans might catch that one. But we have a married couple and how this plays out, and there's some nuance of based on your state's regulations of some other strategies that you might want to consider. So in our last 10 minutes here, Mark, let's attack this married couple situation that you might see come through your office.
So I'll move through this fairly quickly. Married couple, we've got husband going to the nursing home. So I kind of refer to John here as the applicant spouse because he's going to be the one ultimately needing and wanting to apply for Medicaid. Molly is known as the community spouse because she's still living at home in the community, and we're looking at $9,900 a month. So, you know, for most people, that's going to be a financial crisis. So this is a married couple crisis case. They've got a home. They've got $100,000 in the bank. John's IRA is $100,000, and Molly's IRA is $200,000. Again, same financial information. We want to know what their monthly income looks like. And John's at $1,500 a month and Molly's at $1,000 a month. So
way lower than the $9,900 it takes to pay the nursing home bill.
Correct. So in John and Jane's state, John's going to be allowed a $2,000 amount. Jane's maximum amount for community spouse resource or asset allowance is $154,000. IRAs are countable for both spouses, so we're going to have to deal with that. And then we've got John's life expectancy and we've got Molly's life expectancy. So John's going to take out $25,000 from his annuity or his IRA, excuse me, his IRA to spend down. And you know, spending down is always fine. If and either spouse, John or Jane, buys something that is for them, that is just fine. So funeral, a prepaid funeral arrangement, as long as it's done the right way, that's an exempt asset. It's not going to go towards the $2,000 for John or the $154 for Molly. And then John's got $75,000 in his IRA, and he uses that to create income for him. So John's income is now increased. It went from $1,500 a month, probably just Social Security, and now his income is $2,542. And Molly is the beneficiary of that IRA, and the Medicaid agency, the state is named as the secondary beneficiary. So Molly can keep up to $154,000. So the home, we put the home in her name, and that's okay. An important thing to note here is that gifts or transfers between spouses don't affect eligibility. You know, what we're going for is John's eligibility. So transferring assets from John to Molly or Molly to John, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but transfers between spouses are not gifts that create penalty periods. And that's helpful. That's very, very helpful. So that's no problem with John transferring the home. Molly keeps $100,000 of liquid assets, and she also is able to keep $50,000 in her IRA. So that would mean that from an asset standpoint, John and Molly are right where they need to be. Exempt assets, whatever the value is, don't count. And then, you know, we said that in this case, John can have two and Molly can have 154. So their magic number is 156, 156,000 or less. And as long as their assets, counted assets in their name are 156,000 or less, John's going to get Medicaid. And so to get them down, you know, we've got Molly purchasing an IRA, Medicaid-compliant annuity, or she, within her IRA, she is purchasing a Medicaid-compliant annuity so that we can get rid of these excess assets that they have. And in this case, that's going to transform excess assets to a stream of income that's payable to Molly. So again, on that on Molly's IRA, you could name John as the beneficiary. That I'm not saying that makes sense or not, but you could. But you're going to have to name the state as the primary beneficiary unless you name John as the primary beneficiary, unless there's a minor or disabled child in there. So that's kind of financially what you're looking to do in these cases, is that you have to figure out what it is they can have at the time of application, and anything in excess of that, we need to get rid of it. Getting, you know, if you're gifting it, that's going to create a penalty period and you have to privately pay for that. So you don't want to do that, generally speaking. And if you have a married couple case, you generally don't have to. So the tax consequences are, is there's going to be income coming out every month there's going to be income coming out of the Medicaid compliant annuities inside the IRA. That's okay. But John gets immediately eligible for Medicaid. He's got his income of $2,542. Molly's income is $5,167. And so she's not going to be able to get any of John's income. John's income is going to have to go towards care. So, but at least we're not having a big financial hit on John's IRA. Now, again, morbid conversations. But if John's life expectancy is kind of long or longer or could be a longer period of time, it may be worth it to liquidate John's IRA, pay the tax, move the balance over to Molly, and let Molly do a non-IRA Medicaid compliant annuity, because then John's income is less, but Molly's income is more, and you know, Molly may prefer that. So there's lots of things you need to look at with retirement accounts, and what drives it a lot is the taxes. If John's IRA was $800,000, that's a pretty long life expectancy to make the taxes worth it just to liquidate
right.
it.
Yeah.
So the larger an IRA, the more you really are probably going to be wanting to call Krauss Financial and look at the Medicaid compliant annuity solutions within that IRA. So you don't have to liquidate it. $800,000, that's, you're going to pay $350,000 of income tax on that all in one lump sum. Is he really going to live that long to chew up $350,000 of tax? Probably not. So it might be, these cases, I would look to do a Medicaid compliant annuity for John that pays as little as possible.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the key here is that second bullet point down is he's immediately eligible with a copay of $2,542 minus, as opposed to paying that original $9,900 amount, and he can be immediately eligible should they implement this plan. There are some ways to avoid having John's IRA payment go as his copay. One of those solutions is called we're going to use what's called the name on the check rule. We're going to go through these pretty quickly, but we do have resources on our attorney access platform about these strategies. But just know in some states, what you can do is take the payment of income from the institutionalized spouse and transfer the payor as the community spouse. And so therefore, their name is on that check of accepting the payment from the IRA. Therefore, the income goes back in our situation to Molly because she's named as the primary beneficiary. And then she can either continue to receive those annuity payments or elect to receive a lump one. And so I'm trying to get to where, there we go. The possible solution here is we take what was left in John's IRA and we make Molly the beneficiary of that IRA MCA. So her monthly income is going to increase by the $1,042 that in the previous example we were giving to John that increased his amount of copay. So instead of that payment going to John, we're going to have Molly's name on that check. And so her income is going to increase. And you can see the way that the math shakes out here, where John's income goes lower, his copay goes lower, the savings from implementing this plan is even higher. And you can look through those. And again, we have a lot of resources on name on the check on the attorney access platform. But another twist to this, and we won't go too much in detail because again, we do have a webinar on this on our platform, that Mark uses from time to time is the qualified domestic relations order. We're out of time, but Mark, do you want to do a quick synopsis of when this comes into play and how you use this with your clients?
Yeah, so normally we're familiar with qualified domestic relations orders in cases involving a divorce. And so that's normally where you see it, but not me who did this. I kind of latched onto it after I heard about it and found out about it, but you can obtain a quadro, a qualified domestic relations order, without having to be have there be a divorce proceeding or a legal separation proceeding. So that's the setup of qualified domestic relation order law. That's all from ERISA of 1974, the Employment, Retirement, and Income Security Act. You can get a quadro that is not pursuant to a divorce or a legal separation. So quadros pertain to the assets that we mentioned earlier. They pertain to retirement accounts, primarily 401ks and 403bs, and they pertain to pensions for income purposes. It's something that you may want to look at. IRAs and Roth IRAs are governed by not 401 of the Internal Revenue Code, but by 408. And in 408, to transfer those without income tax between spouses, it does have to be pursuant to a divorce or a legal separation case. So IRAs are a little bit different. You can transfer, you know, the reason quadros are sought after is so that you can transfer a retirement account, a 401k, a 403b. You can transfer a retirement account from one spouse to another without income tax consequences. So if you know, making this up, if two spouses are getting divorced and one of them has a $1 million 401k and the other one has a $200,000 401k, that's $1.2 million. To even things out, you're going to transfer $400,000 from the $1 million to the other spouse who only has $200,000, and you want that to be an income tax-free transfer, so that both spouses have $600,000 of pre-tax money. That's where you normally see a quadro. And those are for qualified retirement accounts. I call them ERISA-based retirement accounts. And so IRAs are not ERISA-based retirement accounts, and they don't have – so to get a tax income tax-free transfer from one spouse to another of an IRA, it has to be pursuant to a divorce proceeding or a legal separation proceeding. But for a 401k – You can just petition the court and ask for it.
Excellent. Yeah, so work with a local family law attorney to get the court order of that account transferred to the community spouse. And so you get the same result as the name on the check, where that payment is going, in our case, to Molly rather than to John through that court order. If you want to learn more about those, Stephanie Prestige, hopefully that's how you say her name. She's a lovely individual. And she's kind of the one that was out front on a lot of these in marriage quadros that require legal separation. And Mark, once you get that order, you don't actually have your clients go all the way through with terminating any sort of marriage or anything like that, correct?
No, I mean, so if it's a asset or I could do a quadro, there's really – it's not a divorce and it's not a legal separation. If it's an IRA, so let's say the applicant spouse has a $800,000 IRA, and I want to move that IRA to the community spouse. I have to either do a divorce action, which I do not want to do, or I have to do a legal separation action. And I explain it to the clients of saying, look, think of this as a financial separation. You can still live together. You can be married in every single sense of it, but in our instance, the legal separation really means financial separation. We go and get the court order that we're after so that the IRA of $800,000 can be moved income tax free from the applicant spouse to the community spouse. And once we get what we want, and the IRA is now no longer in the name of the applicant spouse, but is now actually in the name of the community spouse, then we go back to the family court and we have a stipulated motion to dismiss the legal separation. Their marriage is completely and totally reconciled now, and they don't want to be legally separated anymore.
Well, thanks so much, Mark. We are over on time, but thank you everybody for attending our webinar today. I didn't see any questions come through. If you do have one of these cases, please reach out to us. Have a discovery call here at Krauss Financial. We obviously specialize in the Medicaid compliant annuity, and our planners have been working for many years with these IRA Medicaid compliant annuities, and we'd love to help you and your clients out. Feel free to schedule a call using that link you see there on your screen. And Mark, I can't thank you enough for this two-parter. And those of you that want to catch part one or check out that Quadro webinar, you can do that on our Attorney Access platform. So Mark, thank you again so much.
Thanks, all the attendees.
I hope this was helpful for you and your practice to see how some of these strategies are put into play.